for argument this morning is United States against Synergy. Mr. Keisler.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. As the Court is aware, we've raised two issues in this appeal. First, as to some of the claims in the case, the non-attainment new source review claims. The jury was improperly instructed to apply a standard that wasn't in effect at the time of the projects. And second, with respect to all of the claims in the case, the government's expert testimony should never have been admitted under Daubert. As to the first issue, there are two propositions that are central and undisputed. The first is that the only standard enforceable in these cases is whatever standard was in the state plan that had been approved by the EPA at the time of the projects. That's what the Clean Air Act says, that's what the EPA's regulations say explicitly, and that's what the Supreme Court held in the General Motors case. Also undisputed is that
if you prevail on that point, expert issues academic at that point? Or?
No, Your Honor, because that point only applies to some of the claims in the case. The Court would still have to decide the expert issues because there would be the remaining claims under the PSD, or Prevention of Significant Deterioration Program.
Those are what, for later?
Later modifications
or what?
The county in which the Wabash River projects exist was in attainment for one pollutant. Not nitrous oxides, and not in attainment for the other pollutant, sulfur dioxide. So for some of these plants, there were claims under both pollutants. The claims involving nitrous oxides were assessed under the PSD program. The claims under SO2 were assessed under the non-attainment new source review program. So this objection that we make applies only to the jury's findings that there were excess emissions of sulfur dioxide.
Okay. Thank you.
It was also just undisputed that during this time, the EPA had a frequent practice of conditionally approving state plans that were not fully caught up with the latest federal regulatory changes. Because of the frequency with which the federal regulations and standards were changing and the length of time with which these state plans were left pending at the EPA, it was often the case that a state plan that had been fully compliant with federal regulations at the time that it was drafted and submitted had fallen out of sync by the time EPA was ready to act on it. This happened so often the EPA had a name for it. They called it moving target syndrome. And they had a way of dealing with moving target syndrome, and that was to engage in conditional approvals. They would approve the plans in full, and the condition was that the state would undertake to promptly draft and submit a revision on the issue on which the plan was discrepant. EPA would undertake to review and act on that. But the revisions couldn't be effective and weren't effective unless and until the EPA acted on it. This was seen as a sensible way of transitioning in frequent regulatory changes without the state plan process grinding to a complete halt. And sensible or not, it's what the EPA did, and in particular, it's what the EPA did here. Indiana drafted its proposed state plan at the time that the federal regulations required a potential-to-potential standard, a standard that compared the maximum potential the unit had to emit before the project and after the project to determine whether there was an increase that required a permit. So the plan that Indiana submitted pervasively reflected the potential-to-potential standard. It reflected it in the substantive provisions. It reflected it in the definitions. And the EPA, in its complaint in this case, paragraph 48, cited precisely those provisions and said those were the applicable standards for projects in non-attainment areas in Indiana prior to 1994.
What does it mean? So we're talking about Section 43. I find it puzzling. What do you interpret that actually to mean?
What, Your Honor, the potential-to-potential standard?
Section 43, the modification, definition of modification.
Well, the definition of modification is any change which increases the potential emissions of any pollutant. And the way that standard was developed and applied by the EPA at the time, potential was defined as the unit's maximum capacity to emit. So you looked at the maximum rated capacity of the generating unit and assumed that it was operating 365 days a year, 24 hours a day. And then you would compare that to what output you would have after the change. Again, 365 days a year, 24 hours a day.
I realize that's a different standard, but I mean, I realize there are these two different standards, but I don't find this Section 43 clear. Because one way of reading an addition to an existing facility that increases the potential emissions is that, well, it keeps the facility going. Otherwise, it would close, or it would just produce less electricity because its parts are wearing out. So wouldn't that be increasing the potential emissions of the plant?
Not under the definitions that were in place at the time. The federal
definition of terms in Section 43?
Well, I'm looking actually to the federal regulation at this point, which defined
interested in what Section 43 means.
That's right, Your Honor. And I was referring to the federal regulation only because Indiana was seeking to apply that federal regulation, and that federal regulation had a definition of potential. And the definition of potential was maximum capacity to emit a pollutant. And since you wanted to compare apples to apples, the same measurement before the project as after the project, you would be looking at what the maximum output of the plant could be if it was operating at full capacity all the time before,
well,
and seeing whether that's...
Well, it's operating at full... If operating, that's critical. Now what is it that makes you think that definition gets poured into this Section 43 by virtue of the use of the word potential?
Because I think it is a plain reading of that definition.
I don't like plain reading talk.
I think it's the most natural reading of that definition, because it says potential emissions were emissions that were changes that increased the potential emissions of any pollutant.
Well, as I say, it does increase it in the sense that the potential emissions are limited by the, structure of the plant and so on. If its parts are wearing out, its potential emissions are lower.
But then you're not measuring the same thing each time. If you're looking before the project and the potential emissions are the maximum capacity of the plant if it's run all the time.
No, but all the time. It's not, this hours of operation is not in this Section 43. So my question is, what is it that shows that this Section 43 is picking up that regulatory definition of potential?
I think only that it was seeking to apply the federal standard at the time, and the federal standard
where
was...
Where is this? What's the indication of seeking to apply the federal standard?
Well, the state plans had to comply with the federal standard.
It has to comply, but it doesn't have to seek... maybe it does, but does it have to? Would this have been disapproved if the EPA had understood this to mean that it wasn't potential for to potential?
If the standard hadn't changed and there was a federal standard of potential to potential, then I think it would have been disapproved if it hadn't sought to mimic the applicable federal standard under the Clean Air Act. In fact, the standard did change while this was under submission from a potential to potential standard to one that was instead based on actual emissions. And the EPA didn't disapprove it.
I know they didn't, but the question is, did they assume, believe, and want Section 43 to be referring to potential standard rather than using potential in a more, colloquial sense?
Well, I think since potential was a defined term in the federal regulations, and since...
Well, is it really? Where is the definition of
in
potential?
Appendix S of what was the federal placeholder regulation that was in
That's
effect...
something we have?
We've cited it in our briefs. It was the set of
regulations... Do you have the text of it somewhere? Or do you know what it says?
What it says, it defines a source's potential to emit as the maximum capacity to emit a pollutant, and it defined major modification as a change that, quote, increases the potential emissions rate of certain pollutants by 100 tons per year or more. So if potential means maximum capacity to emit a pollutant, then a modification is a change that increases...
Of course, this doesn't say major modification in Section 43.
No, but at that time, they were using the same standard for both major modifications under the PSD program and modifications under the Non-Attainment New Source Review Program, which was a change in the potential to emit, which was defined as the maximum capacity to emit a pollutant. And the federal.
Are you ready to go on to the Daubert?
If you'd like to.
Or do you want to. Is there something you want to finish here?
Well, I'm at the court's pleasure. I can move to the Daubert argument if Your Honor would like.
Well, I was very interested in the fact that, you know, you argued that the district court's Daubert decision or determination warranted no deference because the court, according to your view, rendered mere cursory statements and failed to undertake the necessary analysis. But it seemed to me that that was a bit of a skewed picture of what actually occurred in the record, which shows that in addition to considering the briefs, the court engaged in a rather extensive, detailed discussion with the attorneys regarding the experts' qualifications in a Daubert hearing, which spanned 55 pages of the transcript. And I wondered how you can contend that after reading that transcript, how we can conclude that this was a cursory determination that lacked the necessary analysis.
I didn't mean to suggest that the district judge acted in a cursory fashion, but his order was cursory, Your Honor. He did read briefs. There were submissions that were extensive. There was an oral argument. But at the end of the day, the order he issued was a two-sentence order that merely reflected the legal standard and said that he concluded that the testimony was admissible. There was nothing in that order that provided any analysis or that grappled with the issues we presented or that I think evidences the application of discretion to which we think the court could defer.
So, in other words, the back and forth, the questions that were asked, surely you saw which way the wind was blowing.
There were very few questions asked, Your Honor. But in any event, it was a full hearing, but our focus is on the order. And if the judge doesn't give reasons for his or her analysis, then we think there's very little for the court to defer to. In the other cases in which the court has refused to defer to cursory district court analysis, there may well have been extensive briefing and extensive argument. It's impossible to tell from the court's opinions. But what the court focuses on is if the district judge doesn't himself or herself offer a written opinion that explains how he or she is exercising discretion, there's really nothing for the court to defer to.
I understand. These are obviously reputable people, experienced. What exactly is your problem with their admissibility of their evidence?
Well, first of all,
I can argue about how much weight it should get, but what's the problem?
The argument is that they did absolutely no testing, no verification.
Look, I don't understand. You know, talk about peer review and all that stuff. Look, that's not they're not academics. This is what they do. You know, these projects and projections. That's their business.
But they can engage in real-world analysis of data. They can do a statistical analysis of all of the real-world data that's out there if they're going to posit a mathematical relationship between the availability of a plant.
But they do this all the time, and they do it for other companies. And
Your Honor,
just
Dr.
Doing,
Rosen...
What are they doing different here than
Dr.
Than
Rosen
they do?
Doesn't do this all the time.
Let me finish my
question.
What are they doing different here from what they do in their regular practice?
Dr. Rosen indicated that he had never dealt with a like-kind replacement project, absent the new source review litigation he had been involved in. This is not a methodology that he had ever engaged in before litigation. It was developed entirely for use in this litigation. The EPA had never published...
Well, how does it differ from what he does do in his ordinary practice?
He does other things like testify on behalf of ratepayer advocates and otherwise consult with utilities, but the particular...
No, I'm asking you, what is the difference between what he does, the advice he gives companies, and what he testified to here?
Because the particular mathematical relationship he testified...
Well, what's the particular mathematical relationship?
It is that when the availability of a unit to be used for generation increases, he said that the generation from that unit will increase proportionally upward. That if you make a unit more available by making it function more, that the utility will go to the unit proportionally more in order to seek generation.
Well, that's of course likely, but I know you say these are just backup units and so on, and there's not going to be an overall increase in output. Sure. Well, why doesn't that go to weight? Why does that?
Because what Daubert says is that before you get to go to the jury,
I mean, if you improve what I understand is going on here, these old plants are wearing out. And so you're replacing parts and so on, and as a result, you're going to be able to keep up its production. And that means emissions, right? Now, you say, well, they're just backup plants, and the overall output of the network and so on won't increase. Well, okay. But why isn't that the sort of thing that one would argue about in the trial? Why does it go to whether they're offering a competent study?
Because the fundamental principle of Daubert, as we see it, is that in order to get to the jury, there has to be some application of something like the scientific process.
Well, he employed techniques that were established in the industry, and he had significant practical experience in the area. I was wondering if you could identify what peer review boards or publications you believe the experts should have utilized before testifying on these matters.
I think he should have tested his methodology against real-world data, Your Honor. The EPA has mounds of information. Utilities record this on availability and utilization. There is no problem with conducting a statistical analysis to determine
But presumably he's hired in order to make these estimates of the effect of, you know, renovation on your capacity to produce electricity. The problem you're concerned about, I think, has to do with the demand for electricity for the and how the company distributes the any increased demand among its various facilities. Maybe these backup facilities don't end up producing any more. That seems to me to be an issue, economic issue, business issue, that's different from the kind of technical stuff that he does.
I think, Your Honor, it is testable.
Because I don't see how you can have a mathematical model that's going to tell you how much more electricity the entire system is going to produce.
Well, no, you're assuming that the electricity being produced by the system is going to be constant, because the regulations require you to assume that demand is constant. And so the question is, how will that fixed demand be allocated among different units throughout the system?
Yeah, and that seems to me to be a different issue from what the effect of the renovation will have on the capacity of the particular plants to produce more.
I don't think it is different, Your Honor, because what Dr. Rosen did, which we thought was his fundamental error, was that he looked at each individual unit in isolation and said if availability increases...
And so what should he have looked at?
He should have looked at the system as a whole, because the government was saying at the same time...
You're stating now what seems to me a very different argument from what's stated in your brief. Mm-hmm. Judge Posner asked you, as I understand it, whether the expert statement about the capacity of the plant was correct. But I thought your position was that the actual testimony did not concern capacity. But the thing you're worried about was the statement that capacity would be used in the future in the same ratio as it had been in the past.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's not a mathematical point. Mm-hmm. That's an economic projection. Now, the question for me, which I will ask to your adversary as well, has nothing to do with Daubert, and I wish people would stop talking about Daubert.
I beg
it has
your
to
pardon.
Do with Rule 702, because Rule 702 superseded Daubert. Right? 702.1 says the testimony has to be based upon sufficient facts or data. Now, the question that interests me about this is what were the facts or data that lead to a projection that capacity would be used in the future in the same ratio as the past?
There was absolutely no data, Your Honor. He looked at each individual unit and posited as an assumption that if availability increases, there will be more generation. The only thing that the government has pointed to...
So you argued that to the jury, presumably.
Well, we did, but Daubert does say that there are some things that don't get to the jury if they haven't passed a sufficient, or Rule 702, Your Honor, I apologize.
Daubert was replaced by Rule 702, which is not the same as Daubert. And it's Rule 702 and not Daubert that controls in this case.
And that imposes the facts and data requirement that Your Honor referred to, and there are no facts and data on which Dr. Rosen relied to posit that generation will increase at the same rate as availability. The only thing that the government cites in its brief as any validation for what Dr. Rosen did on this precise point.
Now, what do we know about what happened for these generation units in particular?
I can answer that question in part, but I need to explain on what basis I'm answering it. The trial judge excluded from evidence any evidence about post-project emissions. So there's nothing in the trial record that answers the question Your Honor just asked.
Let me back up. Judge may have excluded a trial because the comparison was either potential to potential or actual to potential actual, right?
Yes.
But it would not have been excluded from any hearing to determine whether the experts were offering a sound opinion. So it ought to be in the record. It ought to have been in at that.
The only point at which it's in the record is there is a work paper with respect to one of our experts' depositions, which was part of the record in the Daubert hearing. And that wasn't subject to any testing, but I'm certainly happy to share with the court what it showed. Mm-hmm. And I should say, though, that the numbers that showed on actual emissions are larger than what Dr. Rosen was looking for because they included increases in demand, and those increases would have to be excluded from this analysis. But even inflated as to the increases in demand, those numbers showed that 35% of the time that Dr. Rosen projected that there would be a significant increase, there in fact was not. And the other times, the numbers were all over the map. They bore no relationship to what Dr. Rosen projected. This isn't a question of being off by a small factor. The actual numbers, even inflated, show that he was wrong 35% directionally and wrong all the other times in terms of even getting into the ballpark. Because what he did was he ignored the two things.
Was this presented to the district court as a reason why Rule 702.1 had been flunked by the Rosen testimony?
It was not. We presented statistical analyses which showed that the government's data, that the government's conclusions didn't work. We tried to correlate availability and utilization and showed there was no statistical correlation of the sort that Dr. Rosen proposed.
Why was this not presented to the district court? If somebody, I understand your objection to the testimony. It was that the testimony assumed itself, right? If you assume that there'll be a 60% increase in output, by God, you'll produce a 60% increase in output. But since Rule 701A, 702.1 says facts are data, you have to compare the assumptions against the facts. But if you didn't ask the district judge to do that, how can you complain to us?
In fact, the district court was completely resistant to having any post-project data mentioned, so much so that at trial, when we tried to ask Dr. Rosen simply the question, have you done anything to test the statistical validity of your projections against real-world data, which could have been from other utilities. It didn't need to be from Synergy. The government objected to that, and the court sustained the objection. So, Judge Posner, when you ask whether this goes to weight rather than admissibility, we weren't even entitled or allowed to establish for purposes of weight that Dr. Rosen had engaged in absolutely no statistical analysis.
Now, that's a pretty compelling point. It was the district judge who said, well, it's admissible, but you can argue against its weight. And you're now saying you weren't allowed to argue against its weight.
Correct. When we asked that question, Your Honor, the government's objection was sustained. I see my white light is on. If the court has no further questions at this time,
okay.
I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Attorney counsel. Mr. Dunn.
May it please the Court, Jason Dunn, on behalf of the United States as well as the states and citizens in this action. I'd like to begin with actually the statute of limitations issue that's the subject of our cross-appeal before addressing. I was going to say I want to first, before I do that, address the last round of questions about the exclusion.
How about the paragraph 43?
First, a very important point, Your Honor. Synergy waived its argument for this test.
Oh, no. Come on.
Uh-uh.
Go on to your next point.
Yes, Your Honor. Even if Synergy, and we, as we explained in our brief,
yes,
we,
all right. Go
we
on
do think they waived
point,
the argument.
Please.
But even if the court concludes they didn't.
Even if, and just go to your
yes,
next
yes,
point.
Your Honor. Synergy's capacity test is wrong as a matter of law. There's only one reading.
But look, this paragraph, look, the EPA approved this this paragraph of the you know, state implementation plan. So, and it looks as if, you know, by approving that, they're approving the potential-to-potential approach, even though they didn't like it.
As your Honor noted, that language is ambiguous, and I think it's important.
Yeah, but that's my argument. You didn't argue that in your brief.
No, well, Your Honor, with respect, we pointed out that the statute and if you look at.
I understand you have this argument that somehow it doesn't comply with the statute, but then the EPA should have disapproved it.
Well,
of course, disapproved other paragraphs in the plan. But it left this one alone.
Right. Well, of course, EPA explained in the 1981 preamble that the definitions at issue were inconsistent with.
Well, so why didn't it disapprove? I mean, it's very it's hard on a company to say they approved it and you know, so we thought we had a safe harbor. Now they're telling us they shouldn't have approved it and therefore we're liable. I mean, how does a company plan when it can't rely on the approval?
Well, Your Honor, they can rely on the approval, and in that approval, EPA explained that reading that regulation as a capacity test would be inconsistent with the statute and with the D.C. Circuit's decision in Alabama Power. EPA explained this in both the 1980.
But it disapproved other paragraphs because they didn't, you know, they didn't clearly track the law. When they approve this without comment, that creates the impression that this is fine.
Well, they didn't approve it without comment because they noted, again, the statute and the D.C. Circuit's decision in Alabama Power.
They didn't say anything about the paragraph, though.
And then what EPA said...
Did they say anything about this paragraph 43?
Your Honor, I think...
Did they say anything about it?
Nothing specifically, Your Honor.
What do you mean specifically? Did they say anything about this paragraph 43? Answer is no.
Yes, Your Honor. Our argument relies on the context of the approval and the context
of EPA's.
Well, that's too
murky. I mean, if you get an approval from the government.
Well, of course, Your Honor, the regulations, the non-attainment new source review regulations, then at 5224B specifically said that when EPA approves a non-attainment NSRCIP, it must be carried out, quote, in accordance with the requirements of the statute. And, of course, EPA had explained...
Well, that's implementation, yeah, but the paragraph was approved, and to implement it in accordance with the statute would change the meaning of it.
Well, with respect, Your Honor, I don't think it would, as Your Honor pointed out.
This is a blunder, let's face it. It's a stupid blunder by the EPA.
Well...
It's taken years to catch it.
Well, the argument that Synergy has made is that this test finally made it into the non-attainment new source review system in 1994. But, of course, if you look at the preamble to the 1994 Federal Register, it says nothing about a new test in that preamble. It refers, in fact, to the change as a mere recodification that is both routine and non-controversial. The fact of the matter is that even Synergy interpreted these regulations as requiring a comparison of actual emissions beforehand to the expected emissions afterwards. And that's the district court found that. Synergy's environmental permitting engineer testified to that in a deposition that the district court relied on. And yes, this was a clever argument that could be made, but it's not the only way to read that language. And in fact, in context, given the statute and given EPA's approval, where again EPA said that those definitions were insufficient for new source review purposes, and then contemporaneously said when you implement the non-attainment SIP, you have to implement it in accordance with the statute. And then you look at the 1994 preamble and you see that EPA nowhere suggests that it's creating some new test because, of course, the test that we applied is the same test that this court held applied in the interlocutory appeal, and it's the same test that's required by the Clean Air Act itself. The comparison of the impact of these availability-improving projects on the expected emissions from the source.
I do want to ask a question about the statute of limitations, and it is under your interpretation of the statute of limitation issue, is there no time limit as long as the violation continues so that, you know, you could delay indefinitely filing any court action and rack up significant penalties?
No, Your Honor. The statute of limitations clearly has a role to play here. Our argument is that we are entitled to penalties for Synergy's illegal emissions, its failure to operate with the required permits, and its failure to meet new source review requirements in the 5 years prior to the filing of the complaint. Synergy's contrary reading of the Act provides a powerful incentive for companies to ignore the important operating requirements that are imposed by the new source review law. Of course, that's a law that was designed to reduce emissions from the operation of new and modified sources.
What is the best language that you could point to that would indicate that the permit is meant to be in the nature of an operations permit as well as a construction permit?
Well, I think you can first divine that from the statute. There's strong textual evidence in the statute itself that...
Right. I'm asking you for that language.
Yes. And if you look at Section 7475, is the operative provision here, requires that says that a violation is construction without having a permit, and then it goes unless, and there's a number of provisions here. The first is that there's a permit that defines emission limitations, and emission limitations are further defined as limitations on the emissions for a continuous basis. So it's clear from 475.1 that the permit that's required is a permit that constrains operations. In addition, 7475A4 defines the emission limitation as backed, which is further defined as a continuous emission limitation.
Now, there appears to be a split in the circuits as to that issue.
Yes, Your Honor, the Sixth and the Fifth Circuits have held that penalties for the 5 years prior to the filing of the complaint are actionable, and the Eighth and the 11th Circuits have held to the contrary. With respect, the Eighth and the 11th Circuits have failed to understand that the statute does make clear that this permit is a permit that must impose emission limitations. Of course, it has to be issued prior to construction, but it's very clear the permit requires operating conditions. And in fact, EPA has long, as we discussed in our reply brief, EPA's longstanding interpretation is just that. In fact, EPA has, in administrative actions, has sent permits back, PSD permits, new source review permits, if they don't impose continuous operating limitations. So there can be no question that the actual permit that they failed to get here would have required operating restrictions. There's an additional basis, in addition, and in fact, if I could, Your Honor, the district court recognized that if a source fails to obtain an operating permit, the continued operation without that permit does give rise to ongoing violations that would subject it to penalties. Where the district court stepped off the track was in failing to understand that a new source review permit, by its terms, does impose operating conditions because it does impose emission limitations, which are defined as continuous restrictions on emissions. It does impose a backed requirement.
So if I thought that the permit at issue was undoubtedly a construction permit, the rest of the question would be, was it also in the nature of an operations permit?
Yes, Your Honor. The permit is undoubtedly issued prior to construction, but it's such an important construction permit that it also imposes operating requirements. The analogy, I guess, would be is you don't need to worry about restricting the operations of a source if you've required it before it can even exist, before it can even operate, to have a permit prior to construction that would limit its emission limitations to back levels. And that's exactly what the statute and EPA's reasonable interpretation of the regulations requires. And if you look at those regulations, the Sixth Circuit actually found that to be an independent basis for finding an action for penalties, because those regulations specifically provide that a major modification shall apply emission limitations. And the major modification must meet emission limitations. And this is 5221 J1 and J3. Those provisions, by their own terms, impose a requirement for modifications to meet emission limitations. That's what they say, and that's what EPA has reasonably interpreted them to mean. In the preamble to the 1980 regulations, EPA specifically said, and this is at 45 Fed Reg 52722, Section 165 of the Act provides that a modification constructed in a PSD area must apply best available control technology. And again, best available control technology is defined as an emission limitations.
Do you want to say something about the expert testimony?
I do, Your Honor. The trial court here clearly did not abuse his discretion in admitting Dr. Rosen and Mr. Coffey's testimony. He did exactly what he was supposed to do. He held a Daubert hearing.
He could have been a little more explicit in his order.
Well, of course, Your Honor, this court has held that even oral rulings don't need to specifically repeat the mantra of Daubert. But, of course, here the written ruling actually did. It made very clear both.
Well, Synergy argues that these experts, they've never done the same type of projection of increased output that they did here in their other work.
Well, I do, and of course, as Mr. Coffey explained, he actually has done this very type of work for 30 years. Mr. Coffey is one of the developers of the generating availability data system that was developed 30 years ago by the industry to help them track availability improvement projects and figure out.
The problem is that this is not a question of availability, but whether available capacity will be used. Now, what the experts did here is assume that available capacity will be used in the future in the same ratio that it's been used in the past. That's not a technical proposition. It could be used that way. It's an economic prediction. And one would think economic predictions need to be based, as Rule 7021 says, on facts or data.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yet my understanding is that this prediction is not based on any facts or data.
And
it's based on the assumption that what is technically possible will happen.
No, Your Honor, that's not the case. It is based on facts and data.
What facts?
Synergy's own project justifications in this case identified the amount of availability improvement that they hoped to obtain. And then, as Dr. Rosen explained, Synergy has a construction manual that it itself applies. And that manual doesn't assume that availability improvement will be used at its full capacity. It assumes that the availability improvement will be used as it has in the past.
Now you're just saying that this assumption was based on somebody else's assumption. But the question in Rule 7021 is whether it's based on facts or data, not whether it's two people share the same assumption. Let me tell you what gives me the greatest pause about this, beyond the fact that there appear to be no facts or data, and when Synergy offered some, the district court excluded it.
Well, if I could respond briefly.
No, you can't.
Okay.
What really worries me is that on the approach of this model, if Synergy repaired each of its generation stations every year, which it probably does in one or another way, or they'll all break down, if it repaired each of its generation stations every year, this model predicts that every generation station will increase its output every year, and that will happen even if demand is constant or declining. And that can't possibly be right.
Right, and that's actually not, and that is a question that goes to the weight, I would submit, and it's actually not, and Dr. Rosen explained that that's actually not what a full-blown ProMod model would show. The point here is the projects at issue here were projects that were designed to make very significant, in the context of a power plant, availability improvements. And as Synergy's own expert on these dispatch models admitted, if you run a ProMod model and you change the availability of a single unit in the system, it will result in the exact same result that Dr. Rosen calculated. And in fact, the Electric Power Research Institute published a study on this.
The question, as I read Rule 702.1, the question is not whether this model used the same assumptions as some other model. It is whether the assumptions of this model bear any relation to facts or data, that is, to things that you can go out and verify objectively. Now, what Mr. Keisler said is there are actual data about how often these units ran after the repairs, that they tried to get the district court to listen to those data, and the district court refused. And the district court also refused to allow the jury to hear those data. Isn't that pretty troubling to you?
It's not, Your Honor, because Synergy actually moved to exclude those very post-project data because it didn't like what they showed. And this issue was discussed in the Daubert hearing. And
Wait. Mr. Keisler said they actually offered them, the government objected, and they were excluded. What you're saying is you offered them and Mr. Keisler's clients objected?
There was a pretrial motion in limine, Your Honor, in which Synergy moved to exclude the post-project data based on the district courts and essentially this court's recognition. That's what was required here was a prediction of what a reasonable power plant operator would have expected from these projects. As this court noted in the interlocutory appeal, what's required is not prescience, but rather an approximation. Synergy moved to exclude.
Question in a different way. Did these experts ever use their model to post-dict the behavior of plants?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
To post-dict the behavior of plants. That is, the way in which climate models are tested, if you want to know whether increases in carbon dioxide lead to particular warming, the future lies ahead. You can't test them against the future. The future will come in 10 years. What you do is you run your client model as of 10 years ago and see whether it predicts what happened during the last 10 years. That's called a post-diction. Right? It's what experts in that method and many other fields of science who try to predict things like the weather or the climate, any other prediction, you try post-diction. Did these experts try using their model to post-dict changes when other repairs were made?
Your Honor, Mr. Coppe explained that using his same methodology, his experience had been that, yes, indeed, these availability improvements were obtained and used.
But you answer my question. Did they use their model to try to post-dict changes?
Synergy's own expert used the model, Dr. Rothman, and this is discussed in the Daubert transcript.
Your experts used their model to try to post-dict changes.
Your Honor, Dr. Rosen
did. Was either yes or no.
He did not prepare any statistical analysis because, of course, in our view, none was needed here. Because what the question that was being asked was, what would a reasonable power plant operator at the time have expected? And the issue of what actually happened was briefed by Synergy. They moved to exclude the actual post-project data. And as it's discussed in the Daubert hearing, a significant number of projects were actually expected to...
Let me approach it this way. So make it very, very simple. The question is whether if you improve the potential capacity of these plants, they will actually produce more, right? Is that the question?
Yeah, the question is if you...
They can produce more, but will they... Or will they just sit there and back up? Is that the issue?
That is the issue.
Well, wait a second. Yes. Now, your guys, Rosen and Coppe, have they in their practice, not in any sort of testimony, but in their practice, when they're hired by energy companies or others, do they then try to make an estimate of what's going to be the actual output of these renovated plants? Have they ever done that before?
Yes, that's exactly what both of these experts do.
Okay, now how do they do it?
Well,
as Judge Easterbrook said, this is not a technical issue in the narrow sense. This is an issue about business practice? What's the optimal integration of the output of all the different plants in the system?
Right.
So, but do they do this? I mean, do they tell an energy company, yeah, if we do these renovations, you'll probably want to produce X percent more electricity from this plant?
Yes, Your Honor. Dr. Rosen's entire experience actually is as a generation planner, someone who runs those type of utility.
So these but these plans include a prediction as to usage of the new facility?
Yes, Your Honor. A ProMod model, a generation planning model, is the type of model that takes into account the rules of economic dispatch, and as one of those such rules, because these are baseload plants.
But your opponent said, I'm getting tangled in these facts. What you said is fine. If that's true, that's fine. That's what they do. Maybe it's a very crude model, but that's the industry standard. That's fine. But your opponent says, well, but they never did. They've never done what they did in this case in any of their practice. They did something different in this case. So what did they do different in this case?
The only thing that they did different in this case was apply the standard methodologies that they that both Mr. Coppi and Dr. Rosen had used in 30 years of experience to the particular facts of this case in the context of a new source review enforcement action. Dr. Rosen's specialty is determining how much generation will increase. The only thing that was different that Dr. Rosen did was to translate that increased expected generation into emissions. But, of course, that step hasn't been challenged here. So, yes, they had never done it before, but that's because there had not been a new source review enforcement action where someone had used these standard methodologies.
You're saying the only thing they did new was to translate increased generation into increased emissions?
That's the only thing that's different. And even that was based on, again, standard AP42 industry factors. And again, Dr. Rosen explained that because of the principles of economic dispatch, the types of coal units at issue here, which the district court found Synergy had admitted were baseload plants, and that they wanted to run them whenever they were available. In fact, that's why they did these projects. They were deteriorated. They were unavailable to run. There's an economic value associated with running them when they're available. And so the question is, how much more will they be run? And using standard industry models like the 1985 Electric Power Research Institute model, when a baseload plant has its availability improved, the generation will increase correspondingly based on the historic utilization factor. In the words of EPRI, forced outages and utilization factor are independent variables. The rough place where these units fit on the dispatch order doesn't change because of these projects. So you can expect them, and in fact,
requested a jury in this case.
Synergy requested a jury.
Synergy requested a jury? Why on earth would anyone want a jury in a case like this?
And as I mentioned, Synergy's own experts recognize that the ProMod model and these principles of economic dispatch and generation planning confirm that a reasonable power plant operator would expect that when it spends the money to improve availability, it's going to use that availability at the same percentage it had in the past. That's the basis upon which these projects were justified, according to Synergy's construction project manual. And it's the basis upon which the Electric Power Research Institute recommended these types of projects be evaluated. Synergy was entitled to bring its own experts to say, well, the particular utilization factor that was used here, it's too high or it's too low. But, of course, they didn't bring any of their experts to trial. And even if they had, the question of what particular utilization factor was appropriate is a question that goes to the weight. It doesn't go to the reliability of the methodology, because again, the actual methodology here is the same methodology that Synergy used to justify the projects. And if the question is, what did Synergy expect when it renovated its deteriorated projects, what better evidence than its own expectations about the increased generation that would result from those projects? I'd like to also make a policy point about the statute of limitations issue, because Here, Synergy's reading of the Clean Air Act provides a powerful incentive to ignore the operating requirements of the new source review provisions. For years, all the way up to the day that the district court finally enjoined Synergy's illegal operation, Synergy emitted hundreds of thousands of tons of excess pollution at levels well above the applicable emission limits, all while saving hundreds of millions of dollars in compliance costs. There's nothing in the Clean Air Act or in EPA's regulations that suggests that Congress intended such a minor tax on air pollution. And yet, under Synergy's theory, they're only liable for a single $25,000 penalty. Under that theory, it's sort of a no-brainer for them, right? There's no percentage in complying with the law when the only risk is a minuscule penalty and potentially deferred compliance costs, which themselves have economic value. So when you look at the statute, which clearly imposes operating requirements on sources that are modified, and you look at the regulations, which clearly require fact and emission limitations, and you look at EPA's reasonable interpretation of those regulations, and when you look at the statute, which imposes daily penalties for violations, you can't come to any other conclusion than that Synergy's violations subjected it to penalties for the 5 years prior to the complaint being brought in this case. If I could make one more point about the Daubert issue, which is in addition to the construction project manual that Synergy itself relied on and the EPRI manual, there's also testimony from Duke's president, Mr. Stanley, that Synergy based its evaluation of these projects on the economic value of the increases in generation, and this is at Supplemental Appendix 1691 to 92. Now, he said it wasn't a crystal ball guarantee. He said that you couldn't be sure that you would get that precise amount of increased generation, but it was the best estimate available at the time for how much increased generation would result from these types of availability improvement projects. And that was the question for the jury, as this court explained in the interlocutory appeal. The question was, based on the information that was available at the time, should Synergy have predicted an emissions increase? They predicted a generation increase, according to their own documents. The only question was whether or not that generation increase translated into increased emissions. And that's simple math. If the court has any other questions about the Daubert issue, I'd be glad to address them.
Thank you, Mr. Dunn. Anything further, Mr. Kaiser?
Just three things, Your Honor. First, I want to clarify something I said before in case I wasn't sufficiently precise in response to one of your questions. When I talked about our attempt to confront Dr. Rosen with the fact that he never compared it to real-world data, that was in the form of a cross-examination question. It wasn't affirmative evidence that we were introducing. It was asking him, isn't it true that you never did any analysis to compare your projection with real-world data or any statistical analysis?
But apparently that's how it's done in this industry, right?
Your Honor, there is no...
What? I don't understand. Well, according to your opponent, the only thing he did differently here from what he does in his business consulting, is translate his estimate of increased electrical generation into emissions.
That's
is that
false.
Wrong?
That's false, Your Honor. There is no other example outside of this litigation of taking non-baseload units and applying a constant utilization factor to predict that generation will go up as availability increases.
How does he do his other predictions?
I don't know, but this is not an assumption that he's ever made outside of litigation.
I don't understand.
I don't know.
What does he do?
I have no idea. I don't understand.
If you have no idea what he does, how do you know that what he did here was significantly discrepant?
Because Dr. Rosen didn't cite any other instance outside of this litigation in which he had said that generation goes up proportionally with availability. There is no example that the government has given other than what Mr. Dunn referred to here, which is the claim that Synergy did the same thing.
Well, do we know if he was ever even asked that question in any other?
He was asked what supports this, what other things outside the litigation. The whole point of Daubert or Rule 702 is that before you bring something into the courtroom, it has to have some support, some facts, some data, some validation. There was nothing here. The only thing Mr. Dunn could cite was Synergy's own practices, and this wasn't Synergy's practice. With respect to non-baseload units like Wabash, Synergy's processes assumed constant generation. So his citation to our practice is wrong.
But Synergy assumes, what do you mean?
It means that when Synergy would analyze the costs and benefits of these projects, with respect to non-baseload units like Wabash, it assumed that generation would not go up after the project. And I mention that only because...
Now, is that because otherwise it would go down, or what?
Yes, exactly. If you didn't do the project, then you'd have an accelerated decline, and generation would get lower and lower and lower. And I mention this not because it proves our case, but because it is the sole example Mr. Dunn has given.
Yes, I'm now also concerned, because I had understood Mr. Dunn to say that these units were baseload units, and I understand you now to be saying that they were not baseload units. I should think that would make a big difference in how they are used.
It does make a difference. And there was testimony by Mr. Pulskam from Synergy that the Wabash units were among the last ones to be called, and there was testimony at the remedy.
They're certainly not baseload units if they're low in the dispatch table.
And the way that's shown...
How were they used? Were they?
As cycling units.
These don't sound
they
like they could be used as peaking units.
No, they were cycling units, which is somewhere in between the baseload units and the peaking units. And that's shown by a couple of things. First, even Dr. Rosen's capacity factors were 30, 35, 40%. A baseload unit, you get up to 70 or 80% of generation.
I should think the Rosen approach is perfectly reasonable for baseload units, and that's how Mr. Dunn was characterizing it. But if they're not baseload units, then we're all at sea.
As I say,
what did the jury find?
The jury didn't make a finding on that particular fact.
Why did you ask for a jury?
The truth is, Your Honor, I don't know. If I did know, I probably couldn't say it in open court because it would be a privileged discussion.
Okay.
It's a strategic call.
Yeah.
And I
it's
wasn't
strange,
part of the
course.
Discussions.
Hardly. It's not a suitable case for a jury, obviously.
It worked out all right for us on some counts and not all right for us on other counts, and those are the counts on which we're here now. Finally, with respect to the policy issues that Mr. Dunn mentioned with respect to the statute of limitations, it's important to understand the statute of limitations here only applies to these civil penalty claims. The government was free to seek injunctive relief, and it did, amounting to costs in hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to be imposed
on
Synergy.
That's kind of irrelevant, though.
Well, it's relevant only because they've made the argument that we would have no incentive as a policy matter to comply if the civil penalty provision were construed to apply
indefinitely. How much civil penalties are you facing?
Well, it would be $25,000 a day if the court held that it wasn't barred by the statute of limitations.
For how many days? For 4 years? For 5 years?
It would be for 5 years in which the plants were in operation.
That's a lot of money.
It's not as much, though, as the hundreds of millions, close to $1 billion, that they sought in costly injunctive relief. And I say that only because the court should know that Mr. Dunn's suggestion that utilities will ignore the law if the civil penalties provision is applied according to the normal reading of the statute of limitations, that's just not so. The court has no further questions.
Mm-hmm.
Thank the court.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. We'll hear argument now in the case of Payne against Kazon.
Oh, my.
A lot of electricity. Would you believe that many people would...